Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to preview the questions that are printed in the test booklet. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. If you want to, you may take notes in your booklet as you listen. Mark your answers on the separate answer sheet, not in the test booklet. You should mark A, B, or C. Do you have any questions? Look at the questions. Then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
El Niño has existed for millennia. Scientists looking back through time find that El Niño has left fascinating records of its past appearances in an unexpectedly wide range of places. There is evidence in Arizonian tree rings and in Himalayan ice layers. Corals in New Guinea and lake bottoms in the eastern California mountains also provide evidence of previous appearances. Some brought great destruction. Others brought much-needed rain to parched deserts. But what exactly is El Niño, and how does it affect our weather? With us today is our weather reporter, Mike Owens.
Thank you. Well, satellites indicate that El Niño is a massive pool of warm seawater that builds in the western Pacific over a period of months and contains more heat energy than has been obtained from all the gasoline, coal, and natural gas burnt in the United States since the beginning of the century. El Niño is a heat engine. A heat engine, whatever its size, is a device for transforming heat energy into kinetic energy, the energy of motion. El Niño uses sunlight to produce its heat. My special guest, renowned scientist Dr. Timms, will tell us what happens next.
Well, El Niño slowly explodes with the suppressed heat that can turn a small tropical storm into a killer, or that can bring life-giving rains to areas stricken by drought. The massive quantities of energy that are stored in El Niños are the reason why the El Niño phenomenon is second only to the change of seasons in shaping global weather. Although the El Niño water pooling phenomenon is basically regional, it affects climate worldwide because ocean currents and atmospheric winds carry its power out of the tropics and around the planet.
I know it's no use asking why El Niños occasionally reach giant proportions, as it is not known, the answer being hidden in the laws of probability. However, climate science is all about understanding probabilities. El Niño is a climate phenomenon, and despite all the gloomy predictions that El Niños generate, no one can say exactly what the effects of any El Niño will be. Can you, as a scientist, assign probabilities to its possible effects?
Well, we can say some areas will be deluged by rainfall. Others will probably be cloudier and cooler than normal. What you realize when you look at a probability map of El Niño's effects is that the closer you are to El Niño's epicenter, which is the tropical Pacific Ocean, the higher the probabilities of predictable effects become. In North America, which is halfway between the equator and the pole, not many of El Niño's predicted effects have higher than about a 60% probability. Thus, in the temperature zones far from the epicenter, El Niño's day-to-day effects can never be fully predicted.
Thank you. Now, although the El Niño cycle is not as regular as the seasons, we know it appears about 30 times per century, with intervals as short as 2 years and as long as 10. Not all El Niños have the same effect, with some being more destructive than others. Because El Niño is inextricably bound up in a global weather complex, it can wreak havoc halfway around the world, despite being, in essence, no more than a pool of warm water in the Pacific.
Now you will hear the segment again.
El Niño has existed for millennia. Scientists looking back through time find that El Niño has left fascinating records of its past appearances in an unexpectedly wide range of places. There is evidence in Arizonian tree rings and in Himalayan ice layers. Corals in New Guinea and lake bottoms in the eastern California mountains also provide evidence of previous appearances. Some brought great destruction. Others brought much-needed rain to parched deserts. But what exactly is El Niño, and how does it affect our weather? With us today is our weather reporter, Mike Owens.
Thank you. Well, satellites indicate that El Niño is a massive pool of warm seawater that builds in the western Pacific over a period of months and contains more heat energy than has been obtained from all the gasoline, coal, and natural gas burnt in the United States since the beginning of the century. El Niño is a heat engine. A heat engine, whatever its size, is a device for transforming heat energy into kinetic energy, the energy of motion. El Niño uses sunlight to produce its heat. My special guest, renowned scientist Dr. Timms, will tell us what happens next.
Well, El Niño slowly explodes with the suppressed heat that can turn a small tropical storm into a killer, or that can bring life-giving rains to areas stricken by drought. The massive quantities of energy that are stored in El Niños are the reason why the El Niño phenomenon is second only to the change of seasons in shaping global weather. Although the El Niño water pooling phenomenon is basically regional, it affects climate worldwide because ocean currents and atmospheric winds carry its power out of the tropics and around the planet.
I know it's no use asking why El Niños occasionally reach giant proportions, as it is not known, the answer being hidden in the laws of probability. However, climate science is all about understanding probabilities. El Niño is a climate phenomenon, and despite all the gloomy predictions that El Niños generate, no one can say exactly what the effects of any El Niño will be. Can you, as a scientist, assign probabilities to its possible effects?
Well, we can say some areas will be deluged by rainfall. Others will probably be cloudier and cooler than normal. What you realize when you look at a probability map of El Niño's effects is that the closer you are to El Niño's epicenter, which is the tropical Pacific Ocean, the higher the probabilities of predictable effects become. In North America, which is halfway between the equator and the pole, not many of El Niño's predicted effects have higher than about a 60% probability. Thus, in the temperature zones far from the epicenter, El Niño's day-to-day effects can never be fully predicted.
Thank you. Now, although the El Niño cycle is not as regular as the seasons, we know it appears about 30 times per century, with intervals as short as 2 years and as long as 10. Not all El Niños have the same effect, with some being more destructive than others. Because El Niño is inextricably bound up in a global weather complex, it can wreak havoc halfway around the world, despite being, in essence, no more than a pool of warm water in the Pacific.
Number 39. Where does the first speaker say evidence of El Niño's impact can be found? Number 40. What does Mike Owens say El Niño is? Number 41. How does Dr. Timms say El Niño affects the climate around the world? Number 42. What does Mike Owen say scientists can predict about El Niño? Number 43. Where does Dr. Tim say El Niño is centered? Number 44. According to Mike Owens, how many El Niños appear in a century? Look at the questions. Then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
Probation in criminal law is a period of supervision over an offender ordered by the court instead of serving time in prison. Here to discuss the increasing use of probation in the U.S. are lawyer Betty Hughes and probation officer Todd Sweeney. Now, is probation only limited to those who have been convicted of their first offense, Betty?
No. For a variety of reasons, primarily prison overcrowding, but also due to plea bargaining and the potential for rehabilitation, tens of thousands of felons get little or no jail time.
But probationers are supposed to follow strict rules and regularly report their activities to their assigned probation officers. Todd, if they fail to do this, what should happen?
In theory, they should be sent back to jail. Unfortunately, with tens of thousands of convicted felons being put on probation, we've been swamped. There is no way probation officers can keep track of this huge mass of offenders in our midst. Criminals who break the conditions of their probation and should really be behind bars are free. Undetected, they violate their probation terms and commit new crimes.
Are they often caught?
It's not likely with the numbers we're talking about. Even if they happen to be caught, they will probably be given another probation order, meaning they are back on the streets. Too many dangerous people are going free.
I've heard suggestions that probation officers should be more thorough when checking up on probationers. What's your answer to that?
It shows that they have no idea what the situation is like. You cannot be monitoring someone 24 hours a day to know if they are planning to commit another crime. Probation officers in New York alone carry an average caseload of 150 each.
How often and how regularly is a probationer seen by his case officer?
Last year, it was estimated at approximately 15 minutes a month. This sends a very clear signal to offenders that probation is a walk in the park.
It is a cause for concern that probation is not a deterrent. It is incomparable with a significant amount of time behind bars. Again, I want to emphasize that I am not talking about first-time offenders or those who could go through rehabilitation. The more dangerous criminals would not think twice about breaking the law if probation is the only consequence. Even intensive probation programs, which include extra drug testing and community service, cannot watch the offenders at all times.
The system really is failing everyone here. When somebody is found guilty, a judge will all too easily hand down probation sentence after probation sentence.
When probation began over a century ago, it was with a view to giving petty criminals a second chance. Common sense limited it to juvenile and minor offenders. Unfortunately, with changing times, the system is now being used to prevent further overcrowding in prisons. That is certainly not what it was designed for originally.
So what can be done to make the criminal justice system more effective?
I think it's clear that handing out probation right, left, and center is ineffective. The bottom line is, we must expand prison capacity. Although prisons are expensive, Their costs have to be put into perspective. We could improve our present prisons and take thousands of criminals off the streets, but the state must provide the financial support necessary. Then, we can end probation for habitual and violent criminals.
Investment is key, and rehabilitation programs should not be neglected either. Again, significant resources have to be invested for the system to work.
Betty, Todd, thank you very much.
Now you will hear the segment again.
Probation in criminal law is a period of supervision over an offender ordered by the court instead of serving time in prison. Here to discuss the increasing use of probation in the U.S. are lawyer Betty Hughes and probation officer Todd Sweeney. Now, is probation only limited to those who have been convicted of their first offense, Betty?
No. For a variety of reasons, primarily prison overcrowding, but also due to plea bargaining and the potential for rehabilitation, tens of thousands of felons get little or no jail time.
But probationers are supposed to follow strict rules and regularly report their activities to their assigned probation officers. Todd, if they fail to do this, what should happen?
In theory, they should be sent back to jail. Unfortunately, with tens of thousands of convicted felons being put on probation, we've been swamped. There is no way probation officers can keep track of this huge mass of offenders in our midst. Criminals who break the conditions of their probation and should really be behind bars are free. Undetected, they violate their probation terms and commit new crimes.
Are they often caught?
It's not likely with the numbers we're talking about. Even if they happen to be caught, they will probably be given another probation order, meaning they are back on the streets. Too many dangerous people are going free.
I've heard suggestions that probation officers should be more thorough when checking up on probationers. What's your answer to that?
It shows that they have no idea what the situation is like. You cannot be monitoring someone 24 hours a day to know if they are planning to commit another crime. Probation officers in New York alone carry an average caseload of 150 each.
How often and how regularly is a probationer seen by his case officer?
Last year, it was estimated at approximately 15 minutes a month. This sends a very clear signal to offenders that probation is a walk in the park.
It is a cause for concern that probation is not a deterrent. It is incomparable with a significant amount of time behind bars. Again, I want to emphasize that I am not talking about first-time offenders or those who could go through rehabilitation. The more dangerous criminals would not think twice about breaking the law if probation is the only consequence. Even intensive probation programs, which include extra drug testing and community service, cannot watch the offenders at all times.
The system really is failing everyone here. When somebody is found guilty, a judge will all too easily hand down probation sentence after probation sentence.
When probation began over a century ago, it was with a view to giving petty criminals a second chance. Common sense limited it to juvenile and minor offenders. Unfortunately, with changing times, the system is now being used to prevent further overcrowding in prisons. That is certainly not what it was designed for originally.
So what can be done to make the criminal justice system more effective?
I think it's clear that handing out probation right, left, and center is ineffective. The bottom line is, we must expand prison capacity. Although prisons are expensive, their costs have to be put into perspective. We could improve our present prisons and take thousands of criminals off the streets, but the state must provide the financial support necessary. Then, we can end probation for habitual and violent criminals.
Investment is key, and rehabilitation programs should not be neglected either. Again, significant resources have to be invested for the system to work.
Betty, Todd, thank you very much.
Number 45. Why does Betty Hughes say probation is not only granted to first-time offenders? Number 46. What does Todd Sweeney say about the large number of probationers? Number 47. According to both experts, how does probation contrast with prison sentences? Number 48. What criticism does Todd Sweeney make? Number 49. What does Betty Hughes say about the role of probation over the years? Number 50. According to both experts, what are prisons in need of? End of the listening test.